down this road the other day. A mate of mine comes up to me. He said, "You're doing all right, mate?" I said, "Not so bad, actually, mate." He said, "Ah." I said, "I feel like a horse, in fact." He said, "Feel like a horse?" I said, "Ah, champion." Wasn't feeling too bad that day. Anyway, get on with the number. Haven't got much time tonight, you know, so we'll get on with a top entertainment number, this one, D-I-S-C-O. You should like it.
All Broadway musicals sound the same, especially the baritones.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Don. Say, Bill, what's that, Freddy? I've never, never been in love. Do you know something? I've never been in love either. How do you know when you're really in love? I don't know. Well, it's a sudden tangible thing, my friend, you see. I've never been in love before. I never knew the score.
Well, Bruce, they're going beautifully out of Ted Chippington.
Hardly, they seem suddenly seem similar.
You'll have to listen to this conjunction forever now.
The level of their influence is sadly not quite the same. But
no, I don't know. There's like odd people that in doing stand-up, and I can go, "You listened to Ted Chippington in the mid-80s, didn't you?" And they go, "Oh, yeah." And there's about four of us, and we've all been escaping it forever. So, yeah.
And I've been reading up on Lenny Bruce, because I've never really bought a great deal of his. I mean, I've listened to a few things for years. I've been listening to Lenny Bruce Originals records, which I think you brought along. Yeah. That's off. I've been listening to that a lot. But,
you know, I mean, there's a track, The Palladium, but I just think it's 20 minutes long. I think it tells you everything you need to know about not just comedy, but also how live art works, where basically he does the same routine three times in different contexts, doesn't he? First of all, the character's telling his agent. He's doing it in New York, it's going really well. Then he tells his agent, so you hear the routine going down well. Then he tells his agent that he's going to do it in London, and the agent's going, "It won't work, that won't work." He does it in London, same routine, it dies, and you hear the same jokes not working in context, and then he's gone on to the end, like explaining why it didn't work, and then he comes back and changes it all and ends up shouting, "Hang the IRA, hang the IRA," to try and get the support of the British crowd. But I mean, that's kind of like that about
and they take it the wrong way.
Yeah, they take it the wrong way. I love that bit with, I mean,
by agreeing,
kind of,
I think.
Yeah, that kind of thing with like Ted Chippington basically doing the same joke over and over again, and then telling you that he's going to as well later on. I mean, I think it's great. Lenny Bruce as well. I mean, the first time you listen to it, everyone goes, "Oh, this bloke's brilliant." You go, "I don't get it at all. It's loads of incomprehensible Yiddish slang and it seems so sort of dated." And then you realise that, again, a lot of it isn't really about material. It's just funny rhythms. Mm. And you just... Mm. It's just...
Well, people say... I mean, I've been reading up on him and it's kind of... The jazz influence is pretty important to his style. Because kind of the pace of his work. And there's also comments that there was kind of no real divide between the private Lenny Bruce and what you found on stage, and that's
both,
what got him into
both
trouble.
Quite unpleasant. Mm. Yeah,
but there's sort of odd theories about. Like someone said that he's kind of chronic optimist. No matter how vicious some of his material can be, he does hope for something.
Well, that's a thing that I think when people talk about Bill Hicks, so I think it gets talked about probably a bit too much now. But they say he's a cynic, and it's actually the opposite. He's a romantic. And otherwise there would be nothing there. And Lenny Bruce the same. They both have an idealistic streak in them that hopes for a better world. And the failure of the world to live up to their optimistic dreams is what makes the cynicism funny. But if you just have a genuine cynic, a genuine cynical comedian it runs out of steam in the end. Mm. You know?
I mean, you've covered similar areas in your own work, like the Christianity and religion and kind of taking apart biblical lessons and so on. But I mean, do you feel you're coming from the same area at times?
You know, I didn't really know anything about Lenny Bruce till about 95.
It was hard to get his stuff for a long time.
It was. I mean, you got a bit of old vinyl. Plus, I think it would be really ignorant and arrogant of anybody to say that they were coming from the same place as Lenny Bruce today, because you can't begin to imagine the sheer just levels of opposition that there would have been to talk, you know, about something that you would just take for granted today, like a mixed race relationship or anything like that, that would get you investigated or authorised back then. And you know, when you see people getting written about, oh, they're like a social iconoclast like Lenny Bruce, we think, well, they're just not. There's no way anyone can be now because he's been done, and a lot of the work was done by him. You know, so. Mm. I think it's really different.
I was just going to say the reactions to Bruce are interesting as well, even amongst his supporters. Like, have you ever read Kenneth Tynan's essay on him? He wrote it just before he died, but he published it in the 70s. It's kind of postscript on his death. But he picks up on the Palladium, and although he's raving about the man, he says that it's his least Swiftian and least kind of political point, but it's attacking the industry, isn't it?
Yeah, well, also...
He opens it up by saying this how this works.
I think it's really good as well, piece, because it shows that material doesn't exist in isolation from context. And this is this kind of ongoing... I heard a thing today, you know, about... presented by Francesca Martinez on Radio 4, the cerebral pop, you know. And there were loads of points about taste and comedy, but the problem is nothing exists in isolation from the context it's in and the people that are listening to it. And so... And that's why I think that the Palladium piece by Bruce is actually a really good political point, because the same things are received entirely differently in different places. And people on Radio 5 live chat shows like to have a discussion every week about, have they gone too far? Is this distasteful? But there's no like fixed way of describing that, because it always changes depending on who's listening and where you are.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. What about when you sort of... came to Oxford in 1986, would it have been?
Yeah.
Went to Oxford. I mean, had you done any performing prior to that?
School plays.
But nothing to do with sort of comedy.
No, but I mean, again, like, this is, again, people... That was a whole different time. We were really... Because there was... As doing student stuff and student comedy and student drama and whatever, or any kind of fringe drama and fringe comedy in the 80s, the reason the Fringe Festival grew up in Edinburgh was because it was a cheap town normally to go to, so that it was really cheap to stay there and get venues, and you could sign on and you could get benefits. If you were a student, you probably got a grant rather than having to come out with a £30,000 debt. So I think there were all sorts of things that mushroomed up again during COVID that would never happen now. And when young people write to me and say, how did you get started, I say, in an entirely different social context to anything that exists now, so I've got no useful advice to you, because that whole environment was totally different.
I've heard an early recording of it's one of the Seven Raymonds reviews.
Oh, right.
Anyone who doesn't know that was a gathering of Oxford people. But you seem to have stumbled on it by accident, if you know what I mean. It's kind of performing didn't immediately.
No, I mean, it was supposed to be really up to point. I mean, seeing stand-ups that I really liked probably made me want to do it, but I mean, initially I always thought to be a writer, and stand-up was sort of something I could do. And when I first came to London in 89, I had a variety of temping jobs for about a year and a half while I got gigs, and the idea was I could get gigs, and I thought I could probably make about £100 a week out of that if I do four that pay about £25 in Lytton. You know, I could probably give up work and try and be a writer, but then it's sort of like things just get ahead of you. We never know what's going to happen next. I don't understand when people talk about a career plan. I don't know how that will possibly work for anyone, really.
Because I was going to ask about that, you know, when you became I don't know if critic's a word you particularly want to be described as, but when you started with the Sunday Times, and it's always to me that your material in those columns for the Sunday Times, most music journalists are always trying to be funny when they're writing reviews, and it's always struck me that your stuff is deadly serious in that context. But in a very kind of refreshing way, because normally do not get people.
Well, I don't. One of the things I really hate is sort of journalist wit, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can, because it's interesting. Like you kind of see it at award ceremonies or things. Someone who's supposed to be a hilarious columnist goes up to make some kind of speech, and the kind of rhythms of it are so torturous, and the way it's all set up, it actually kind of only works in newspapers, and even then you could dismantle it in 5 minutes if it was ever tested in the hot fire of actually being responded to by human beings in a place. So also the I suppose the thing about that is I suddenly realised about 6 months ago I'm hugely lucky, because one of the reasons I stopped doing stand-up about 3 years ago is because I couldn't get all the other things I was trying to do to work in it, like writing stories and directing stuff and doing things that are a bit more elaborate. And then in the last 3 years, you know, I've had this like fiction published and got to direct some stuff, and I thought, wow, I'm actually going to go back to it this summer, to stand-up, and I can just do it as stand-up. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't got to carry a weight and the imposition of all these other things that I was trying to do in that context. Don't actually work in it. And it's the same with, you know, I feel that's a really privileged position that I've got into in a really lucky way, to be able to write about left field music in the arts section of a right wing broadsheet.
Didn't you once describe it as like being wine critic for Kerrang?
I mean, you feel like you don't want to squander it by trying to be clever. Plus, also, there's so many records come out every week. There's hundreds every week. Why choose a bad one so you can make a funny snide comment about it? It's better to tell people about something good that they might like.
It was quite nice, actually, first time I ever read one of your reviews, which would have probably been for Q magazine, I think, when you did a couple of years for them. And at the time, I was convinced it must be a different Stuart Lee, because it was so... But that's quite nice to find that it was a million miles away from what else you were doing.
Yeah, lots of people assume all the things I do are different people. But that's been... You know, the great thing about that job of, like, writing reviews every week was it did mean that I got to a point... Because all the things I was doing kept getting cancelled or stopped, you know, or there's various reasons why I couldn't tour and whatever. And it meant that I had a sort of... two record reviews a week isn't a living, but it did mean that... two record reviews and one feature a month isn't a living, but it did mean that I didn't have to depend on what I was doing to make a living out of it exclusively, and suddenly that really frees you up hugely. And just to kind of, when you get offered telly things now, you sort of think, well, I could do that, but it will probably go really wrong and be embarrassing and make me angry and depressed, so I won't do it.
I think you can count your TV appearances in the last 5 years on one hand.
Yeah, I expect so. It's been really great. Actually, since I gave up, things have gone really well for me.
We're gonna come on to your sort of famous partnership, I suppose. The one from mid-90s is probably when you were best known for this sort of thing. And we're going to pick a clip from the Lee and Herring Radio 1 show.
Right.
It's one of the sketches, so it's not just hearing yourself back in the studio. But it's Tales That Witness Madness.
Sir... Permit me to speak. You're clearly an English gentleman, as am I. Our journey is long, and as we find ourselves compartmented alone in the same carriage, I suggest we strike up in conversation. My name is Spankfield, Mr. Spankfield. What is yours?
By heaven's light! Spankfield is by no means a common name, even on an English shore. And yet, sirrah, 'tis my name awell.
And fate, the lusty whore, has brought us together. You know, we must flout the laws of manners and best address one another by our first names, Mr. Spankfield. I was christened Hector. What?
Hector?
Yes.
Hector Spankfield?
Yes, that's it.
By the hymnals, we'd best think of another solution to our conundrum, Mr. Spankfield. For Hector Spankfield is my name also.
Why, Prince Albert's face. You jest, Mr. Spankfield, surely.
No, it is as true and real as my ridiculous sideburns alone.
Well, wait until I tell my wife Lottie about this, Mr. Spankfield.
God's hair.
What?
I can scarce believe my Victorian ear.
Why?
Lottie is the baptismal name of my wedded spouse, a wee. But alas, what? Mr. Spankfield, my poor Lottie is an invalid, confined to a bath chair.
Well, hurrah and huzzah, Mr. Spankfield, so is mine.
Good.
Yes.
What a fine pair of fellows are we.
Yes.
Have Lottie and your goodly self sired any offspring, Mr. Spankfield?
Why, indeed we have, Mr. Spankfield. From Lottie's womb have slithered a boy and a girl child by the names of Twecky and Lenkmeen.
By Florence Florence Nightingale's sensible pants. Twecky and Lenkmeme are the names of my little catamites also.
No!
And yet slap my jowls with your fob if I did not make up those names out of a collection of random letters in order to thwart social convention and make my children look like idiots.
By my ass, Mr. Spankfield, so did I. Oh. Wait until my fellows and neighbourmen in the leafless borough of Fulham in London town hear of these similitudes.
By baby Jesus's holy bib, Mr. Spankfield.
What?
I reside in Fulham too.
No.
Upon the New King's Road.
By Queen Victoria's bra, Mr. Spankfield, Lottie and I rent apartments on that very thoroughfare also. You'll be telling me you live at number 19 next like I do.
Mr. Spankfield, we do.
No.
Yes.
You and your wife live in the very same flat as my wife and I.
Yes.
Well, I'm surprised we've never met before.
We are alike as Ping and Poo, the world-famous Siamese freaks.
Fate's stinking finger could find no finer friends than we.
And tell me, Mr. Spankfield, are you gay?
I beg your pardon, I most certainly am not. What in God's realms of reason makes you ask such a question of a Victorian man?
Nothing. Neither am I, obviously. Have you never wondered what it would be like to lay you down with one so similar to yourself in every way?
No, Mr. Spankfield, I haven't. Leave me alone. You're strange.
Oh, come now, Mr. Spankfield. I know that you're just a little bit curious.
No! Now, it is a long way to Buenos Aires, Mr. Spankfield, and I suggest we both read our newspapers quietly and keep on our own side of the carriage.
But, Mr. Spankfield, you forget... I know where you live.
No! What? Your face! It's my face! My face!
Well, that was Richard Herring and our guest this evening on Resonance 104.4 FM, Stuart Lee, who is, it has to be said, squirming in his seat slightly.
No, just
hearing that. But it's just... that's from Radio 1 in 1995. Are you...
That's nearly 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, you were meant to be filming that for television.
Yeah, we tried to do it for television, but we couldn't ever do it. We couldn't do it because... Because it just repeats itself over and over and over again. It was impossible to learn it properly, and it just kind of ground into nothing. It's actually, it's a lot of people talk about that one, because I think it only ever went out once, and obviously, basically nothing I've ever done has been commercially released, so they get sort of circulated about, and that's something people often mention, that one.
Do you find actually that's one of the, if there is an advantage with these sort of things, that because you had relatively little released, is that people are quite obsessive?
Well, I think it's been a huge benefit having had no success, because actually what it means is people have very fond memories of it, but they're not hanging around on DVD or whatever for anyone to check. I mean, there's one radio series out on CD, but they're not hanging around for people to check up and to check up on. And also, I think it means. I mean, I did a little stand up gig last night in Jackson's Lane Community Centre, which holds about 100 people, and about 10 people that had come from Wales, because you've kind of reached this level where you consider, oh, this is a real rarity. Then one of them was saying to me, "Are you ever going to do anything with the Edinburgh show you did 3 years ago about Edward Lear?" And I went, "Well, I can't really tour it because it's too expensive, because it's got a musician in it and whatever. I don't really know what to do with it. I might try and do something like a book with illustrations in it of it." And they went, "Oh, if you ever need a reference, we've got a film of it." And I went, "How did anyone..." Somebody like secretly filmed it in Edinburgh.
Wow.
And that's on the internet, right? And I'm really glad, because it does mean... If I ever lose all my notes, they're kind of all out there on kind of websites and stuff. So it's quite good, really.
What did you make of? I mean, to set it up in case anyone missed this at the time, but there was kind of Lee and Herring Army, wasn't there? And
well, that was that was kind of. I think we had quite a lot of fun with the medium of radio, in as much as you'd suddenly find you had all these people listening to you, and that kind of constituency, I suppose, of that sort of show would tend to be a lot of adolescents with time on their hands, and you could make them do really strange things. Like we picked this local radio DJ
Christopher South,
yeah, from Cambridgeshire, and got just people from all over the country to send him fan letters asking for signed photos, and he must have received thousands of them, and things like that were kind of making little odd Dadaist events happen. But it wasn't like a kind of Dom Jolly thing of let's humiliate an old person. We just had sort of, we had fun putting these odd kind of events into action.
And, well, there was another case of that, wasn't there? In the radio show, which you can actually buy. I think it's on the tape anyway, because it was slightly cut. But there was that one where you rang up a hotel to lodge complaints about the quality of the pornography.
Yeah, that went out of that. Well, that was yeah.
Because that's an interesting one, because it's not winding up the guy. It's a genuine.
Well, it was just about sort of how marketing works, really, which is that it always promises something that it doesn't deliver, and it seemed very funny to do that with the in-house adult channel of a Glasgow hotel.
The theory I had with it is I got the impression that you'd have made the call if you didn't have a show on Radio 1. I do
a lot of things like that, actually. I do. I've just been tidying up my house, and I found a really great letter from the manager of IKEA, where I went in and I had some meatballs in the restaurant, and there were less meatballs on the plate than were in the picture. So I wrote him a letter about it, and he wrote a really long thing back about how the illustration was a representation of the deliciousness of the meal, rather than. Another thing I did was there used to be a daytime quiz show. It was presented on television by a newsreader called Philip Henshaw, I think you would know. Philip Hayton, yeah, that's it. For about 2 years, I wrote him a letter every day after it had been on, saying how well he'd done that day. And gradually, over the years, I became more resentful of him and, like, criticised him for picking on different guests and accused him of having different racial and sexual prejudices and stuff. Always asking him for a signed photo. But he didn't, and at the end of about 18 months, he finally wrote back. He wrote an absolutely charming letter, and he said, "I'm sorry I've not replied to any of your letters."
Any of your letters?
Let me assure you, we do our absolute best to make the show as good as we can. Here is a signed photo of me. What you want it for, though, I can't imagine. Perhaps to throw darts at. Anyway, and what I learned from that was two things. It is very funny to pursue an idea to its end for no reason. And they're often better if they're not even for anything, like not for broadcast or not, because you have the kind of, and I guess that's what we were trying to sort of bring people in on the radio show. The other thing was the sheer graciousness with which this man who I'd harassed, and I'd never done anything like that again now, replied to the letter, and actually taught me a lot about obviously the problem of interacting with the public. It's not something I've had for a long time, because I haven't really done anything of any profile for about 5 years, but you start to get it again now, because I work in music theatre now. I've ended up directing a piece of music theatre that's been a success, and then you encounter a whole load of other people that have got issues with you because you're on their territory. And what I learnt from that quiz presenter was to be as polite as possible, and actually that becomes as well on its own level. But I would do all those things, whatever, and it was nice to have an outlet to do them in.
When you like that, it always struck me, particularly with the way in which the listeners interacted on the Radio 1 shows and things like that, is that it strikes me that too much radio is basically just getting the public to react, whereas you're getting them to create,
to participate.
Well,
I really liked that. I really liked that aspect of it, and to kind of make weird art happen was really great. And you see all sorts of people that used to do stuff and send it in, you know, like funny graphics or things that they'd made turning up in a kind of professional capacity later on, and that's really great. But I think that, you know, I've always really liked that kind of thing, of sort of random assemblies of things, and it was great to have that access to people. But then it does look, I mean, another thing I did was I put out a call for passport photos for real reason, and I ended up with about 1,600, and I tried to do things with them, just of all different people from around the, and they still occasionally turn up. And actually, it starts to look kind of sinister having that many passport photos of strangers in your house. Well, but
it's in the Fist of Fun book, isn't it?
It still goes on for years. You still get passport photos of strangers from places. And when I saw that film Amelie, where the guy is obsessed with collecting passport photos, I thought, if only I'd had some kind of idea to do something with these, because It was really great. And then people would, like, raid their offices, the security files of their office, and you'd suddenly get a wedge of about 60 where they'd all been sent in from some security department of a bank or something. And that was really good. Stuff like that was it was good to kind of put the ideas into people's hands.
I think also I was only going to say that because obviously you'd started with Richard writing for the dreaded Weekending in 1990, and it struck me that, you know, again with topical comedy is such a narrow field. I mean, we were just talking before we came up here about, for reasons we won't go into here, we had to look at a little bit of Rory Bremner's show on Sunday night, and it's just still doing the same thing.
Yeah, although the weird thing about that is I used to really hate that, but the news is so depressing now that I almost feel like I'm really grateful that someone's just saying something. But I think the thing about doing all that topical comedy that was really great is, I'm not saying that any of the things we've ended up doing have been that amazing, but, you know, even say Jimi Hendrix did an apprenticeship being in show bands, and I kind of think that the 2 years of writing for those, for Weekending or whatever the equivalent would be now, probably Dead Ringers, is kind of, it's like being in the sort of salt mines of comedy, but actually you learn a craft and then you can sort of choose to reject it.
It's the discipline
There's something to be. There's a really funny line by Simon Munnery where he says, "Many are prepared to suffer for their art, but few are prepared to learn how to draw." And I think there is something in that. Like,
I think Shauna William,
she produced Weekending when we did it.
She said that writers take about 4 weeks to get it on Weekending.
Yeah,
perhaps she was being generous. I don't know, but that seemed to be the average.
They either stay in that world forever, or you just have to go.
Bob and Barbara Bolton.
You go mad. You know.
Was that where you met Peter Bainham? Then was it?
Yeah, Peter Bainham he writes Alan Partridge now and everything, but he just left the Merchant Navy actually, and it was such a great variety of people on it. He's doing an animated program that everyone says is going to be great.
I am not an animal. It's called.
Yeah, it's about animals in an experimental lab, and they get given human personalities so that they can test marketing on them. And it sounds like it'll be really good, and I hope it works out for him.
But we should perhaps mention Sarah Smith at this point, who is the common link between Weekending and what we're about to play next. I mean, it's that whole world of Langham Street.
Well, I know you're writing. You know, you're trying to write the book on all this, aren't you? But actually, there's a lot of people that. There's a kind of thing in the media, I suppose, and where comedy nudges up against notions of celebrity, where there are kind of celebrity producers like Harry Thompson or whatever. And then there's other people that do real hard graft that really stick their necks out, and they don't really get any thanks for it. And she's one of them. I think she's suffered quite heavily from that. And in fact, you know, there's a whole corporate structure in broadcasting whereby people are often rewarded for not taking chances. Like, who's that guy that used to be in the heebie-jeebies, who became a radio producer, TV producer?
Jeffrey Perkins.
Mm. Jeffrey Perkins was head of comedy development or something at the BBC for about 4 years, during which time no one noticed that he never commissioned anything. If he'd commissioned something, someone might have noticed that he wasn't really making any choices. But as long as you keep your head down,
he's gone back to producing.
People kind of stick around for ages, and that's the kind of weird thing about that structure, whereby kind of flair is as likely to be punished as it is to be rewarded, and on the admin side, you know. And so she continually was threatening to quit unless things that she'd worked on were commissioned, and actually she had to do that, and history's sort of shown her to be right, actually.
Michael Nimrod was one, I think.
Yeah,
she
and
said,
other things as well. I mean, it might even have been League of Gentlemen. There's another thing that she did on the radio that they were umming and ahhing about. And, you know, she's always threatening to quit. And in the end, she threatened to quit over something and did quit. And they went, all right, off you go.
Well, I think she was meant to be doing, what's that, the 99. She was meant to be directing that. And the Only Fools and Horses director has done it now. So I don't know whether that was...
I don't know. I don't know anything about
it. It weirdly disappeared on that. But, anyway, back to the topic. The next clip's Alan Parker's show from 1993. And I was wondering, and I know you'd done an Edinburgh show before then with Simon Munnery.
Yeah.
Do you want to set up how you came to know Simon Munnery? I mean, it's a bit before then.
I just saw him in Edinburgh in 1988 at the festival when he used to do a double act called God and Jesus. And I instantly knew that they were Ted Chippington fans because it had the same tone of that, where it was really monotonous jokes done by these blokes that just looked like idiots, you know, real kind of creepy kind of idiots. And there was nothing really funny about it apart from the fact that it wasn't really funny at all and was yet presented as if it were comedy. And I saw him do the most fantastic heckle put down where they were on at the Fringe Club, and everyone loves to talk about, oh, Edinburgh's a bear pit, whatever, but in the, you were just, people were just being attacked by the audience in the 80s, like physically. It was it's much more, because it's kind of been colonised now, it's much more genteel. Mm. And even what are supposed to be legendarily bad venues have a kind of bonhomie about them. Mm. And but anyway, they were on stage, God and Jesus, which was Simon Munnery and this bloke Steve Cheek, who is now some kind of academic in Bristol. Mm. And they were, audience were trying to boo them off and were chucking stuff at them, and I think they only had plastic glasses in the bar, and Steve said, "We'll only go if you throw glass," right? Which was, and then people started doing that, and that was really, but they were so brilliant, and I'm really glad that I got to work with him. And in fact, somebody sent me a questionnaire about theatre stuff the other day saying, what are your major influences, you know, and I put Simon down, which is odd because he's someone that I know, you know, but actually he's not an influence in terms of you try and copy what he does, but just the dogged pursuit of his ideas, many of which do not work, is something that is, you know, really inspiring.
Well, what we got lined up at first is a clip from the Radio 1 show, right, a piece that you did for him, which we'll talk about. I'm sorry to put you through it.
I think we've also got a song. And then, is it the other way around?
I think is the song, is the song working, or is the disc behaving?
We can try.
We can try. Okay, well, in whichever order then.
All right,
let's see what
happens. You're welcome to play the fucking guitar. I'm starting, Calling out to all you media types with your non-jobs. Talking shite on your mobile phone.
And I'm not talking to the unemployed. Unemployment is a job in itself. You have been left on the shelf. They left the shelf on you. Get a job, get a job. Earn yourself a few more. Buy a cooker or a fridge. Let's smash it up, we don't need machines. And if you've got a job, my message is a simple one. Do it well. And when Friday comes, take your pay, pack it with pride. Then give it back. Let them know you don't need their money, only their respect. Get a job, get a job. Get a job, get a job. Earn yourself a few more. Buy a cooker or a fridge. Smash it up. We don't need machines. We don't need machines. We don't need machines, 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 we don't need machines.
Right. Hammond actually writes for Chords Weekly, a music publication. An unpublished music publication, I should add. He's been looking at an aspect of the music business for me. Incidentally, how do you spell business, Hammond?
B-U-S-I-N-E-S-S.
Hey, what are those last two letters again?
S-S.
Cheers. Yeah.
Sam band there of Suede, who with Denim are two of the new bands trailblazing what the Weeklies are calling the new fabric sound. It's a sound that kills, metaphorically speaking.
I'd say that Wedding sure was bad.
Now, London and Suede have come out of nowhere, while Denim are from Birmingham, an altogether dissimilar place. In the 80s, Denim were known as Felts, and they wove a distinctive sound of their own out of Dylan-esque vocals, television-style guitars, and a densely knit woolen material up to 2 inches thick. Suddenly, all over suburbia, every bored kid who can strike a glamorous pose, play a few chords, and think of a one or two syllable word that describes a piece of material is creating their own new sonic fabric environment, literally.
Hello, everybody. We're Leicester's very own young new fabric warrior fox, and we're called Wool.
Cocaine-fueled cynicism we've come to expect from their sluggish, bloated corporate rock prostitute carcasses, major labels haven't been slow to try and create their own identikit false fabric band. A&R man Peter Letmeme of A&M Records has precision engineered his own young hopefuls, Terry Lean, but to a blueprint he's too old and too comfortable and too fat ever to understand. The so-called group features someone who was once in Chicory Tip on drums and a small boy singer in a shrunken woman's blouse who appears to have 3 nipples and all 3 of them as excited as sharpened bullets. Letmeme demands a tray of ice cubes backstage in every dressing room in case of glamour emergencies. Nice try, corporate rock scum, but Terry Lean is a man-made fabric, and it's got 3 syllables. Will you ever understand? The fabric-clad fans are asking each other the same question, and it's this. Some guitars, some blokes, their nipples, and the 1 or 2 syllable name of a fabric. God damn it, it turns me on, but is this all there is? No, 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 you stupid, dull, glamorous, beautiful young fools. Of course it isn't all there is. There's love, sex, drugs, and the human desire to question. But for now, just for a moment, throw yourselves into the fabric and let it smother you. Suffocate and go down. That's what pop music's for.
Oh, we love that.
Can't remember anything of that. No memory of it. It's really funny.
Is that you?
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah.
I mean, no, you don't get that in the Sunday Times, obviously. No. But no. I mean, it's interesting that whatever you remember that show would be great. But the relationship you have with Alan Parker in that show is fantastic. And it's also on the record as well. On some of the tracks.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably... That actually is one of those things that sort of plays itself out in life. It's odd because... I've worked with Simon on and off for, probably about 12, 13 years, that. And he's one of those people that views me as a kind of square control freak, right? And so that I'm quite useful for trying to make him do stuff in a more accessible form. And then weirdly, there's also a whole... There's a whole other wedge of comics that I work with that view me as this mad wild card that they could bring in. So it's obviously like being right in the middle of this this whole thing, and he's the absolute extreme of where you go and work with him, and you're kind of the square bloke going, why don't you just face the front rather than lying on the floor and speaking into where no one can see you, or why don't you do this? Do you know what I mean?
It's so yeah.
But actually, yeah, that relationship in that's probably exactly the same. And these recordings he's been circulating of the Alan Parker band had exactly that shape to it as well, where I played everything on that apart from the drums that Al Murray did. I think there's another bassist on some of them.
I forget his name.
Andy Marlowe. I mean, we used to do gigs as that, which were hilarious because he has absolutely no sense of rhythm at all, and so we'd have to just kind of make everything so that something would fit into it. And we spotted the Lightning Seeds once in Liverpool, which is a weird thought.
I remember seeing I remember seeing Simon in Brixton, and I was talking to him afterwards because he sent me a copy of the CD, and he said two strange things. One of which was copy it for other people, despite it being a numbered limited edition. He wanted me to do 12A, 12B. Right. That was pretty good. But he also went off on a tangent. We were talking about the record, and said, "Well, some of it sort of reminds me of Dragnet by The Fall, which is a reference Stuart will Yeah. But it's like beginning of Spectre versus Rector, where it sounds like it's not going to work, and then suddenly it falls together.
That's entirely down to him, because we'd have all these songs worked out with whatever the tempos were, and he'd always go 1, 2, 3, 4 and they might be in waltz time, but they'd always start like that.
There's one that just starts, he just goes 1, 2, 3, 4 and you just get like sort of some guitar being strummed for a bit.
It was good fun, you know. I mean, of course, secretly I'd much rather have spent 2 years of my mid-20s trying to be in a proper group rather than one that was a parody of one. But but yeah, it was really good fun.
Attention Scum, which I mean, really, you know that I was kind of as frustrated as anyone else by the way it was treated at the time. But
oh, that was his BBC Two show.
Yeah. I remember him saying to me then, costed him another gig around then, and he said that the BBC was like a cloud to him. The closer you got, the more perplexing it was. Well, he seemed to have an odd relationship.
I think he was unlucky in that he came to do that show at a very peculiar time for mainstream broadcasting, whereby it's done now. It's a done deal now that there will be a 3 and a 4, and that 75% of the country won't receive it. And that if you're awake at 2 a.m. and you go, "God, that was a good documentary," you'll suddenly find out that it was commissioned for BBC Four, and you wish you could have seen it on a terrestrial channel. But that at the time there was a lot of kind of debate about how things would be funded and where stuff would be placed. And I think that series just sort of fell through the cracks of that. Really,
stuff never got trialled in those days, did it?
No, they wanted to kind of nail it. They wanted to wipe it out after about 2 weeks, I think, because I think if something that left field had actually drawn viewers on BBC Two, it would have undermined the whole notion that you couldn't have that on BBC Two and that you needed other channels to put stuff like that on. You know, so I think it just arrived politically at a really bad time. Plus, to be fair, about 25% of it wasn't good enough. You know,
it was the first comedy show in living memory that's used Derek Bailey on the soundtrack, I think.
Yes,
it was actively left off the field anyway. But
yeah, you know what? That made me cut that down. That was about 4.5 minutes.
It's the DJ Ninja.
It's from drum and bass.
Was I the only person who recognised it?
Well,
maybe?
Derek Bailey recognised it as well.
Really?
Yeah,
you interviewed him around then, did you?
Pardon?
You interviewed
him? No, a few years before, but we have an odd kind of correspondence. Because he was very surprised to find out that I was a stand-up comedian, that I liked all that kind of music, and then he sent me a tape of Chick Murray and said, you know, this is what I think stand-up is. And I mean, he's been doing some really good stuff lately with spoken word, with poets. He's done two albums with Will Gaines, this tap dancer who I used to do gigs with in the mid 80s on like variety bills, you know, late 80s. What you get off those is a really great thing where, because Will does all like Catskills comedy kind of 50s kind of take my wife please sort of gags in between. He's like a proper old style entertainer, and you can kind of feel Derek Bailey working around not only the rhythms of the tap but also the audience response to the laughs, which is probably something you don't get in a lot of free jazz gigs. And I'd love to try and do something with him with a stand-up, or get him to do something with a stand-up. I don't know what it would be, because I think you'd get this third element, which would be the laughs. And I know that someone like him can always play with like the sound source of whether it's tap dancers or a percussionist or another instrument. But the idea that you could have this third thing, which would be audience response, is quite an interesting.
Yeah. Well, the only times I've seen Bailey, it's absolute silence in the audience.
Yeah.
I've never even known him in quite a noisy environment. He did All Tomorrow's Parties, didn't he?
Yeah, that was probably amazing.
Relatively.
Yeah, that was really great. Loud though, but I'd love to see that happen. And weirdly, it's the kind of thing I only started thinking about when I got involved in this opera that Richard Thomas wrote about, the Jerry Springer talk show, because I realised that he'd scored in like where laughs come, basically. And it's kind of he said to me that he thinks of the audience as like an extra instrument. And of course the risk with that is the 1 in 10 times when everyone hates it, there's just these kind of spaces in the music. But normally it's kind of interesting that you can build in what you can. It does keep it interesting, because it's obviously it is a scored piece, so it kind of, it doesn't have that looseness that you'd like from live performance in a way, and especially when there's a band of 8 and 35 singers. But the fact that there's laughs, right, it's just something you don't ever get in that kind of music theatre. Yes. And it does create a funny elastic element in it that is one of the things that means, even though I'm professionally obliged to go and see it about once a week, I'm still not entirely suicidally bored of it, because there's always that risk of change. You know?
And we've all still got the rest of the year to see it, I believe.
Until January, although I doubt, you know, I don't know anyone that can afford to go and see it. I'm hoping that there'll be I have had a conversation with producers whereby they say, you know, if it recoups its investment, they'll bring ticket prices down. But, you know, had I known 3 years ago that it would end up being a big success and going to the West End with all the compromises that come with that about how much it costs to do, I don't know if it's something I'd have got involved in, because I find it really embarrassing. But you look around it like, that's how it works.
Well, lovely tangents, but we should play a couple of clips now and rest our breaths.
Saying about Simon then. Yeah. We've got another Simon clip coming.
Oh, great. Right,
from well, pre-Alan Parker, really. Yeah. This is from a programme that went out on Radio 4 in 1988 called The Word Made Fresh, which was like a
Playwrights Festival thing.
Young Playwrights.
Never heard of that.
Coogan was in it as well, actually. But
it was around the time of Hey Radio, which is where...
Oh, right, I heard them on Hey Radio, yeah.
And a lot of the material in this clip is similar.
Right.
So
here we go. Simon Munro.
Hello, good evening. I am a security guard. I have a few security guard jokes for you. How many security guards does it take to change a light bulb? One! We're not stupid. These three security guards go into a pub. Nothing happens. But that's what we get paid for. A door with two Yale locks and a safety chain. Not so funny, that one, but extremely secure. What do you get if you cross a security guard? Trouble! So don't do it. It is quite a good life as a security guard. Social life is good. We have our own club. It's called the Security Guard Club. Used to have a more continental sounding name, Club Security Guard. Some people took that a bit too literally. Don't clap, it's patronising. Anyway, I was driving along on my moped. I knocked this woman over. She said, "Why don't you look where you're going?" I said, "I was." Mother. Quite a nice moped, blue, 50cc engine, automatic transmission, shopping basket on the front, and some blood. Brakes don't work very well, though. I got stopped by a policeman. Well, slowed down a bit anyway. He said, "What's your name, Sonny?" I said, "Good try, but it's Simon." I said, "What's your name?" He said, "Superintendent Roberts." I said, "Your mother had foresight." Which I considered extremely witty. Anyway, time for a few more jokes. Saw a bloke the other day, looked a bit like Dave. You don't know Dave, of course. It's a private joke, that one. What do you say to a man with no arms? "Excuse me, you have no arms." Have to be cruel to be kind on some occasion.
And there we go. That was Simon Munro from 1988 on The Word Made Fresh. And... We're now going to play some John Shuttleworth from a live album he put out.
And this is Stuart's choice, I should have. We've been punctuating this too often.
It's a bit of speaking.
Some speaking from John Shuttleworth.
Bit peckish now, that talk of seafood. So if you don't mind, I have a little bit of my track about. That's all right. No, you see, because I had my tea at a reasonable hour. 5 o'clock. I'm a bit hungry now. I know younger people have it much later, don't you? You know, probably had it just before you came out. Perhaps not even had it yet, you know. Went to Little Brasserie later. But, no, you see, I know this about young people because having the tea later, because there's a group of young people live across the road from us in a big house. It's a bit dilapidated, you know. And I'm taking the dog for a walk about 8 o'clock, 8.05, something like that, you know. We'll have had our tea and washed up hours ago. And they're just sitting down to a big meal with candles and everything. It's like Santa's grotto. This is midweek, you know. Yeah. Not because they have no net curtains up, because of everything that's going on. But, no, I come back from my walk about 9 o'clock, 8.50. No, about 9 o'clock. And they'll have finished the tea, but they don't get down. You know, they just sit at the table, playing with bits of paper, and chatting, you know, drinking coffee. Yeah. Funny, isn't it? Yeah, I think it. I don't like them young people. Tell you why, because you know, my brother-in-law, Carl, came up recently to visit with his young family. And he's got a new car, Proton. J-Reg, lovely motor, you know. We thought it'd be nice if we had a photograph of it outside our house, because we've had it concreted over now, it looks much smarter. And our partner, Ashley Massader, next to it, Y-Reg, showed it up, you know. And Darren's friend, Plonky. He's called Mark, really, but he says, call me Plonky, Mrs. Shuttleworth. You know, everybody does. And at first, yes, you feel uncomfortable with that. But after a while, it's fine, you know. Come here, Plonky. You know, it's natural. Anyway, he's got a purple Datsun. So he parked it up. Ken wanted to park his Honda Civic there. But I said, there's no room, Ken. There's no room, because there wasn't. You know. He's got his own drive, anyway. Anyway, we all sat in our respective vehicles. My wife Mary stood on the wall and took a little photograph of us. Looked across the road, saw these young people stood in the bay window, killing themselves laughing. Yeah. Well, you don't know why, because they haven't got a vehicle between them. You know, that's a final irony, isn't it?
Hello, you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Clear Spot. My name's Ian Greaves. Justin Lewis is with me, and so is Stuart Lee, our guest for the evening. That was John Shuttleworth.
Yeah, actually, just thinking about that, that's another thing that goes way back. Being about nine and getting the Jilted John album that he did, that came with a Snakes and Ladders game and had little bits of drama in between the... tracks, like a weird kind of concept album about an adolescent in a kind of Coronation Street environment. That's and, you know, that's another thing I'd kind of forgotten about that I think is... I love just the mundanity of it, you know. Everyone goes on about how good Rob Brydon is, and I think he is, but I think that Graham Fellows...
It's something about his rhythm as well, it's something where stopping on every possible point of conceivable interest doesn't feel unnatural.
No, and also, he's not afraid to develop little nervous ticks and clicks that actually become hugely irritating for Graham himself to have to do. I was talking to him once about when he used to do the radio show, and he did the voice of Graham, of John Shuttleworth, and also Ken.
Yeah, he used to dress up for it as well.
He would hate them by the end of the day. He hated the characters. Like, he resented having to spend time with them. He was so kind of furious about them. But he is great.
He also has an amazing way of just delivering quite straightforward lines in a way that are very funny. Like, there's a song which starts with the... I stopped a bus for Sebastian Coe. He could not catch it, for he was too slow. Just so, like, there's a logic there, but, you know.
Also, we'd not played a song tonight, although, it'd be great to. But, I mean, his obsession with rhyme as well is fascinating. He's because what does it tell you about the man as well?
Yeah, I remember I was doing a stand-up gig at... about 10 years ago at this Mexican restaurant in Crystal Palace, and he was what, like the tryout spot. He just started doing that character, having been kind of missing for 10 years, basically. In between, he did a kind of quite serious album, didn't he, after the early 80s.
He had a girl with Shuttleworth in about 87, but it did nothing for ages.
You notice it, you know. And after, when he went on, I just thought he was an old man. you know, anyway, because he's so convincing at it. And then I was talking to him afterwards. I gradually twigged that it was the guy that had done Jill to John, and that's one of those records that I know every single word of from having it when I was 10, you know, and just was so exciting to meet him. You really, you know, it's great being able to meet those kind of people and work with them. And also hearing that clip of Simon earlier on doing the security guard reminds me of when he was a stranger that you really admired, and now he's someone I know that I dislike. No, he's someone I know.
How is he, by the way?
He's not been well, but he's gone to Australia to recover, and... you know, so that'll be good because it'll mean that he'll probably come back and do some more stuff. I know he's doing the Melbourne Comedy Festival in March for anyone who's listening on the internet.
Excellent.
Or wants to go there.
Look forward to it. Anyway, we're going to skip on to interesting thing you brought in, your final choice.
Yeah, well, I've been working on this musical, like I say, and musical opera thing, and someone sent me this. I don't know who it's from. It's like a bootleg remix of one of the songs that's been played in clubs, and obviously that is delightful to know that exists. I don't really know what I think of it, but it's funny to be bootlegged.
Let's play it.
Please welcome Baby James.
Thank you.
my Jerry Springer moment.
Well,
and that's from
Go Home Productions versus French Bloke and Son.
I have to be a versus. If it's a dance record.
Right. If you can find them, good luck.
That's great. I quite enjoyed that.
It's good.
It was something that turned up in the shops sort of towards the end of last year that I knew nothing about until it was on the shelf, and it doesn't even have your name on the packaging, I don't think, but it's the Johnny Vegas DVD.
Oh, right,
which
yeah.
you directed. I mean, that, with absolutely no bearings, I watched it the other week, and
right.
I found it because I've never really given much attention right. to Vegas, but I thought it was an interesting film. I mean, how did it come
about? I think two things about it. One, I think comedians or people that are expressed interest in comedy really like it, because, or at least get something out of it, because it's a lot about how he's perceived, and that notion of, like we were talking about context for things. But I think it was something he really wanted to do, because he's sort of known as this game show panelist, like entertainment figure, and he's not really like that at all. It's just kind of succession of choices he made have put that. So I think he wanted to do this kind of film which he hoped would redress the balance. But we did it in about 5 days, and it was all unscripted. But the live bits are really good. I think the three, there's about an hour of live stuff on it that's really good. Because, I mean, normally, the normal thing for a comedian to do would be to go and film something at Wembley, but Johnny did the opposite and decided to film himself in very small rooms, going quite badly.
In Edinburgh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's really good.
That's interesting. We picked one of the extras at your suggestion, and picked a section of that, which we're going to play out with. We better wrap up pretty quick, though, to get all of it. Now, we've got a list here to save your memory, jogging, of things which you're doing soon.
Oh, right.
Just to plug... 19th, which is Thursday, I think.
Thursday,
you're in
yeah.
Ballam.
I'm in Ballam at the Bedford Banana, and what I've found has just been turned into a benefit for some that Spider-Man bloke who sat on a crane
really?
To get access to his children. Yeah, I don't know anything about it. Anyway,
oh, well.
If you want to see him, he'll be there. He's going to dress up as Spider-Man.
It sounds like an interesting cause, not necessarily a good one. On Sunday, you're back on Resonance.
I'm on here on Sunday on lunchtime.
One
yeah.
Way Single Parent Family Favourites. Yeah. I got the name right.
Yeah.
And the 26th, you're in the Albany, Great Portland Street, Lipstick and Shopping.
Yeah.
And then back on the 29th, here again. Some good Resonance stuff coming in the next week. The Dinks with Dan Antoblowski, which started the other week. That's Monday at 3:30. And Zolob Park, or however you pronounce it, on Tuesday at 4:30. They're good, humorous programmes if you've enjoyed right. anything here. And we're going to play out with Johnny Vegas. Might see you again, might not. Good night.
Good night.
Like you say, I knew I could sing. I knew I had a gift. And the day the call came from Billy Butland and said, kid, don't waste it. Don't waste yourself on civilians. Come and be a red coat. The people laughing work for Pontins. And that's just like a cousin with a bog eye, isn't it? You'll never know the class of Butlins. You've not been there. That's why you're laughing out of ignorance. I went to a place that turned my life around. A place that you can't put in a room like this. You can't contain within a gig. You allow yourselves to be called punters. Butlins, you were people. If you had dog shit on your shoe... I was there to lick it off. At Butlins, we had big windows. And I mean big windows. Windows you could be sick out of, nobody blinked an eye. People could breathe, blokes could be sick, kids could run round till at least 11:30. And unless they got trapped in the bingo machine... somebody would find them in the morning. And by nature, they'd find a way to a sandpit and fall asleep without fear of needles or anything like that. And that was the beauty of... Yeah, ha, ha, ha. That was the beauty of Butlins. It was an holiday that the parents couldn't dictate because they were too drunk and the kids got to do what they wanted. And in the middle of all that, organising the chaos of your life was a red coat. The most infallible bloke in the world. And I learned that word for this gig. Can you imagine? imagine T.J. Hooker, slightly taller, in a red jacket going, it's all right, he's probably asleep in the sandpit. Can you imagine that, love? It's so hard picking on people in terms of, like, chatting to them. In this day and age of mid-morning talk shows where people go, no, I can't, I'm barren. You never had that problem at Butlins. It was taken for granted everyone could get up the duff. It was taken for granted. I know, up the duff, not a modern phrase, but an honest one. If a woman was pregnant and not in love, she was up the duff. That's why she was on holiday on her own, dressing in baggy clothes, like you heard of Sex in the City, and pretending she was a virgin bride. And we'd spot them, and we'd stay clear. But we'd always chat to them, and never look down at that obvious bulbous mistake that she'd made in a disco. That was a red coat. You didn't just run off and shout slag. You spent time with her. You didn't make a point of the fact that she could, you know, balance the saucer on her tummy. You just talked about her dreams of getting into art and design in the 60s. Good luck to you, love. Wish you all the luck in the world. We were a virgin race. Single mothers were frowned upon. Well, they weren't really allowed in. If you did, you slept with the mum, then you became a surrogate dad for the child. All them tears on a Saturday as the kid got dragged away and you're going, you're not man. And I don't really wish you were. It was happy times, but awkward times. That was Butlins. We were dealing with problems before the government ever knew the disruptive. Pre-pill, post-war. We didn't have a slogan, it was too awkward.
I am a family man. I believe in God and the spirit of free improvisation. That is why I listen to Resonance Radio 104.4 FM.
And Yasser Arafat, very sadly, dismissed it out of hand.
Thanks to Ian Chambers and Stuart Lee for presenting The Clear Spot. I'm not Mike Barnes, but this is still scratching the